So, good morning. Thanks for hanging in there with us for this half-day session. And we are going to talk about the future. This is an emerging topic. It's something that's relatively new discussion within the EPRO consortium. But I think one that should be pretty interesting and raises some, I think, stimulating scientific questions, as well as just practical issues. So this is session 8, and this is Bring Your Own Device Applications in Clinical Trials. So this is the standard disclaimer, and I'm going to introduce the presenters and panelists. So first, Hannah O'Gorman from EXCO in Touch is going to talk about the BYOD, the recommendations from the BYOD white paper that the EPRO consortium has just put out a draft, and that's currently under review. I'll talk about that a little bit more in a second. Tara Simons from Pfizer is going to give a sponsor's perspective on BYOD and the appeal and the potential risks to a sponsor. Jonathan, our marathon runner here this morning, is going to give a brief presentation about the regulatory perspective. And then Willie Muehlhausen from ICON is, and I should mention Hannah and Willie are both members of the EPRO consortium and have been active in this conversation, is going to then kick off the panel discussion with some things that we all need to consider. So just to give you just a little bit of background, this is the only slide that I have, and then I'm going to turn it over to Hannah. But as I mentioned, there is a BYOD white paper that the members of the EPRO consortium, a small little writing team, put this together. It's been circulated to the rest of the members of the consortium for review and comment, and so that's ongoing. Once we sort of have the chance to have those internal conversations and debates amongst ourselves, we're going to open that up to a wider audience and engage the PRO consortium and others. So the other thing I'm just going to kind of put in a shameless plug here, both for the CPATH website. We have several guidance documents that are already available on the CPATH website, and I'll give you the link to the EPRO site here, but there's also good information on the PRO site, so I'd encourage you to go out there and look at the things that we have published already. But also, I just want to mention, there's a series of EPRO webinars that are being planned by the EPRO consortium, and so those should be starting sometime this summer, and we're going to be sending out invitations, so keep your eye out for that. And now I'm going to turn it over to Hannah to talk about the recommendations from the draft BYOD white paper.
Thanks, Jason, and thanks again for everybody to stay. We appreciate your time because it's the last session of the 2 days. So from the white paper, as I say, that's being developed and is currently under review, these are the topics that we've basically come together and have put into the paper. Now, these are just our opinions, that there was three of us putting, sort of drafting this paper together, and now it's gone out to the wider team for review. So we may have missed things, we may have overlooked things, and so hopefully when that white paper gets out, we'll get the feedback from yourselves to look at this and then let us know, what your thoughts are, where you think we need to build on this and so forth. So as I say, this is like a start effectively to get this discussion underway, and hopefully this will create a lot of discussion and a lot of input into this paper, and then hopefully, you never know, potential guidelines, potential, sort of in the future. So this is a starting block, effectively. So the broadest definition of BYOD, or bring your own device, is that it allows participants to use their own computer devices to access and respond to study-related questionnaires in a clinical trial. So we're talking about their smartphones, their laptops, desktop PC, tablets, those sort of tools that they are using in their everyday life. And an argument for using this concept in clinical trials is that for sponsors, you've got to reduce cost. You're not having to basically provision devices that are just there for the clinical trial to subjects, the whole infrastructure that needs, the logistics and so forth, so you're saving yourself money there straight away. But also there's a reduction of the burden to the patients. So you've got to think about the end users. Patients are in a clinical trial, they've got a lot going on. You know, when they come for those site visits, there's a lot that they need to do. There's a lot they need to do at home. So if they can use something that's familiar to them and they're comfortable with using, they're more likely to use it. You're more likely to potentially get data from them because it is something that they're familiar with. And then this has a knock-on effect then for study sites, because then they don't have to sort of train the patients to use these devices because they're using their own devices. So therefore there's reduced burden on them. There is reduced burden on the logistics of basically dealing with provisioned devices, giving them out to subjects and so forth. So you're helping the sites there as well. And then so it's long term, this probably enables more sort of patient-centric studies going forward. So you know, it's sort of helping that sort of limited site involvement. So the site can concentrate on the important things they need to and not have to worry about having to keep training patients to do things with regards to ePRO devices. So obviously, you know, the discussions today have all talked about training. We appreciate that it's vital, but then it loses its strength if you have to keep retraining, and therefore it becomes more of a burden to the sites. But then we have to look at the other side, the flip side, and what are the issues against using BYOD in clinical trials? And the main point that comes up is equivalence, basically, of validated instruments. Because you're using sort of different platforms, different operating systems, different screen sizes, and especially if those data are going to be used for labeling claims, how are you getting that equivalence between the different devices that potentially subjects are using in a clinical trial? And therefore you need to sort of look to that regulatory standpoint and do the migration, and therefore it's a modification, so you need to demonstrate that it's equivalent and show that it's fit for purpose. But you've got such a range, how do you actually sort of measure that, and how are you able to sort of control that? So currently, when we're looking at equivalence across platforms, if you're using mixed modes in a clinical study, as we know from the ISPOR task force, you need to show equivalence between those modes to be sure that you're collecting viable data. And this approach may become impractical with BYOD. You know, what is it that you are sort of like measuring against, you know, sort of what are the concepts. Now, because of this, you might just need to think of actually with mindful programming, the only effect that actually might be different might be screen size, because you could program it in such a way that it will render the same in different operating systems, different devices, but then if they're different screen size, you just need to show that equivalence. And is it, and this is still, you know, we're still asking these questions and we're still looking for the answers, is it that you would just measure the equivalence from the smallest screen size that you know is going to be used to the largest screen size, and if that shows equivalence, then does that cover all, that you've got everything in between? So, you know, it shouldn't be seen as not using BYOD in clinical trials, but it's definitely a challenge that we've got to overcome, and we need more work on it, and we need to do these studies to show this equivalence and if it is possible. Also, with bring your own device, I mean, we're talking about, as someone said, everyone's pretty much got a smartphone here. You know, sort of everyone's sort of sat there catching up with emails and so forth. So we just have the expectation that everyone's going to have access to these devices. Now, there are populations out there that may not have access to these devices. And what do you do then if you want to use this model in your clinical trial? Do you actually make the ownership of that device part of the inclusion criteria? Well, that's a very good way to make sure that you're going to get the right devices used, therefore the ones that you've proven to be equivalent. But then you're creating potentially a biased sample. You're just removing a whole population of people out from that sample that don't have access to that. So that's got to be something that we need to consider. But we could also use this idea of, well, if they don't have their own device, not, you know, don't make it part of the inclusion criteria, but actually provide them with a device that they can use, which, you know, basically covers that hurdle. But then it sort of goes away from the whole idea of bring your own device. You're going back to a provision model. So it's a, you know, it's a way of getting around that, but it's sort of not the brave new world that we're sort of hoping to move into. Then there's considerations that we need to think about actually getting software onto all the phones and devices. So obviously there are different methods which we can use to actually create these questionnaires and collect data from. So we have the web-enabled devices. So actually using the internet and the web browser to basically be the interface between the patient and getting the data into the databases. Now, that's a good way of doing it, but you need that active internet connection to be able to collect that data. And because on a web platform, you basically have different browsers and so forth, you may actually have variation between those browsers. So you've got to be sort of really thoughtful of that. And then obviously there's a security around using a web-based model. You know, just how secure will that system be? You've got to make sure that you're planning for that when you build that. The other option is to actually use an app. So this would be like a native app sitting within the device. Now this is beneficial because it will display in a consistent manner across most devices, if not all. And also it allows the patients to actually submit data without an internet connection. And therefore it will just sit on the device until that connection is occurs again, and then the data are sent. So that's a very sort of useful tool to sort of for this bring your own device concept. However, then we just need to think about if there are any updates and so forth, how do we then make those updates onto the different modalities, as it were. With web-enabled, that's fine because it's going to be coming from a central place, and therefore, you know, the patients are just basically accessing that website through their device. But with an app, it's basically sat alone on the actual device itself, so you've got to think about then doing a full sort of build to do the update, and then also try and get that app back out to the patients on their devices for them to actually update the modified one. So that's sort of, again, something we have to consider with regards to this tool, this process. One thing that does come up a lot with the discussions that we've had with Bring Your Own Device, BYOD, is basically the ownership of the device and what issues that could cause, and also the distractions that could potentially come in with basically a patient using their own device. So basically, the main thing is, as a sponsor, you don't have control of that device if the patient's using their own phone. The smartphones, if we're talking about those, are multi-purpose devices. So they can use their phone to complete the questionnaire, but then they will use that phone to basically surf the internet, text and phone friends, you know, do whatever on internet shopping, that sort of thing. You know, it's their means of communication and their everyday life thing, and then basically we're coming in on the side of that. But then this multi-purpose device also has benefits, because then you have this heightened familiarity. They're using this device every day. I mean, virtually every, I'd like to say minute of the day, you know, everyone's got one. You never really leave home without your smartphone now. If you've got one, it's there. You feel lost. So it's that sort of aspect that you've got that there, and therefore you've got that window, as it were, into to the subject, and therefore you can communicate with them. So you have that engagement possibilities with the subject by using their own device. And to be honest, they're more likely to actually respond to notifications on their own devices compared to if you actually gave them a provision device, because they will. If they get a text message, you know, they'll straight away look at their own phone. They may switch off the provision device and then think, oh, I've got to go back to it. You know, it's those sort of things you have to think about. Another thing we have to consider is storage with their own devices. Again, that becomes an issue because you have no idea what other things they have stored on their own device, and you don't know if that's actually going to cause issues with the storage of data. So that's something we have to consider. We also have to consider that because it's their own device, if they're using an app, for example, they can delete that at any time. You don't have control over that. But then you could also make, as part of the inclusion criteria, that is one of the criteria, basically to say, you know, as part of this, you're signing up to this study, you will basically sign to say that you will not delete this app and you will continue to use this as part of your continuation in the clinical trial. And also, again, it's that whole idea of, you know, you have this device that you can send notifications to the subjects, you can interact with them, you can keep them engaged, but they don't have to have those notifications switched on. But again, we can overcome that by saying it could be part of the inclusion criteria, part of the informed consent, that sort of thing. So it's not, you know, a means to say no, that can't be used, but it's just some things we need to consider. Another concern that comes up is who pays for the data. So obviously with traditional methods, when we've actually provisioned devices, basically all the data costs to sending any data were covered by the sponsor. because it was just part of the contract with the ePro vendor for getting those devices out to the patients. However, if they're using their own device, then if they are not, say, using it over the web and therefore getting free web access, and they're using it as their own, sending that data as their own data package, they're going to therefore have costs associated with that. And basically, the reasonable expectation is to reimburse the subjects for those costs. It should be part of the stipend to actually do that. So again, you know, it's something to consider. It shouldn't be something that will cause you not to use it, but it's just something to be overcome. Regulatory issues. I know Jonathan's going to talk more about this later, so it's just a couple of points that we wanted to put down. But it was just, you know, regarding we're actually using consumer-grade devices, you know, in a clinical trial. What issues would there be around that? And also that sort of step further, you know, when does it actually, an app on a smartphone, be considered a medical device? You know, obviously with the guidance that's been released, depending on what that app's actually collecting and what it's storing, and potentially if it is actually calculating anything or anything like that, then you're going into the realms of medical devices. And are you aware of that? And have you then planned for that? And have all the procedures and, you know, sort of boxes ticked, as it were, to sort of cover that aspect. Security is a big one that comes up, and that's both physical and electronic. So you want to sort of know that the data that's actually on the device, on the patient's own device, is secure. So the sort of things you need to sort of think about, you know, are the data going to be stored on the device for any amount of time? If so, they should be encrypted, so that's a consideration. How are those data going to be then transferred from the patient's device to the vendor's databases? What are the security measures in place around that data transfer? And also the subject's privacy, how do you protect that? But then that is a concern with provision devices too. It's not just something that is just around BYOD. Basically, you know, talking of the date of birth, basically, for a PIN, that sort of thing. You know, you've got to make sure those secure aspects are in place. And then also, talking about privacy, what are the boundaries of acceptable data capture? So, basically, in the current regulatory environment, you know, respecting subject privacy is a given. But with BYOD, there might be this temptation to actually garner more information. Well, we can find out certain things about the subject, about what they're doing, about, you know, where they are and how that would affect potentially their disease. You know, if it's sort of asthmatic patient and you can tell from the GPS readings from the phone that they're in a city, therefore that's going to have more effect on them than if they're sort of in a rural area and this sort of thing, you know. But then it's sort of going beyond those realms of, well, do you take that step that far to try and garner that information? Or you're just collecting what you're supposed to be with the questionnaires and the diaries and that's it. So we can also say that technology can be used to decrease subject burden and also subject engagement and increase subject engagement in ways that's not available. But we also need to think about this, you know, how we use them, what information we take for them, and then these questions arise. So, you know, it is this case of what should we collect, who's responsible, what permissions do we have? So, again, we don't have all the answers. These, again, are just things that we're bringing up, that we're thinking about, that these could be potential issues, challenges, but there may be others around that, that you as a group are sitting there that are thinking, you look at those and think, actually, no, you know, there's this one as well. So, you know, we want this sort of feedback from you. So, it's an evolving area, and we hope we will get this feedback from you all. So just in summary, before I hand it over to Tara, just to say that there are a number of challenges that need to be considered with BYOD in clinical trials, but we hope that we've given you both pros and cons for the BYOD model, and hope that we see that although there are these challenges, you know, they're not the ones that can be overcome, but we just need to think about it and we just need to make sure that we've got everybody's input in and everybody's sort of opinion to make sure we've covered all those eventualities. So I'll pass it on to Tara now.
Hi, it's me again. More musings from Tara. Thank you for hanging in there, last session. How do you always get the last session, Jason? Whenever I get this opportunity to present with you, I'm always on last. Okay, so this is one area that I'm very enthusiastic about. Having heard Hannah talk, though, maybe there's more risk than we would like to share, but it's something that I'm trying to push within Pfizer. And I'm going to just go through why we should consider it, what are the potential risks, and then a little proposal for us to consider. So from our perspective in Pfizer, there's increasing pressure to run cost-efficient clinical trials. The biggest number one pushback I get from teams wanting to go EPRO is it costs too much. Just give them some paper, that's much cheaper. So I constantly have that battle with them, a scientific battle, but also to, you know, the implementation, that it's quicker downstream. I get all these vendors to come in and do all that talking and convincing for me. But also, you know, going electronic, the studies can be conducted quicker because we don't have so many data queries. however, not only is the cost an issue within the company, I've had reticence from teams going electronic. We've heard today some of the issues, particularly in that first session around actually using EPROs. Patients can't always use the device, no matter what training you do, or you know the sites forget how to train the patient, so you continually have to update their training. It is resource intensive trying to get the patients able to use this. We've had untold problems with data connectivity, where patients can't download the data and they get frustrated and they just want to throw the device away. And we've had situations where devices have been embargoed, so we can't actually run the clinical trial in that particular country. So it's things like this that teams become aware of, and they're like, look, this study, you know, we need it done by X, we need to get moving, and paper's the best way. So I think if we could move to a bring your own device, I think one of the biggest problems and challenges we have is for the patient being able to use the device and the connectivity issues. It's gone because it's their own device. But what are the risks? I think Hannah's highlighted many of these, but I want to hear from Jonathan around the regulatory space, because it's hard enough, as we know, to get a labeling claim. He left. He obviously doesn't like what I'm saying. So, but it's hard enough already. We know the challenges of getting a PRO labeling claim without then building in the burden of bring your own device. What is Tara up to now? You know, so I think that we have to take into account. And equivalence testing across electronic devices. So I haven't seen a study yet that hasn't shown equivalence. Maybe my one study I did way back, but we won't go into that. But generally, we see equivalence. So what is the error that we're building from, going from a smartphone to a web-based to an iPad? Paper to electronic, yes. And my biggest bugbear is that we use paper as the gold standard, but actually we know paper's flawed, so why would we look to equivalence back to the paper? But across these devices, I haven't seen that much at many publications showing there isn't equivalence. And I think there was a recent publication showing equivalence across a number of modes. We've talked about how, you know, such things as what will happen with compliance, you know, all the distractions, you know, ability to build in alerts because they can switch them off. You're going to get recruitment bias potentially. You could run studies where some can use their own device, some don't, so you provision a device. How would that affect things? How are patients going to be reimbursed? And the security of the data, as Hannah's just talked about. So I don't think those risks are insurmountable. And I think what we need is an evidence base to go back to the regulators and say, bring your own device is feasible, is viable, and is something that we need to move forward with. So my proposal would be that the EPRO consortium takes on responsibility for running some pilot studies around this to look at the impact of some of these potential risks. And this could be, you know, as a consortium, we could all put in $5 and the EVE vendors could put in thousands of dollars. And we could work collaboratively with the FDA as well. It's, you know, that's not a problem either. So, but also single sponsor studies. I've convinced one team, I think, to go BYOD. And a lot of the issues that that have been raised, I think we can address in that study. How many patients will actually be able to do the BYOD? Doesn't matter if they do or don't have it, we'll know what proportion. We'll be able to look to see those that had BYOD and those didn't, are they similar or not? So we'll be able to start to address some of those questions and those risks. And my plea is that if you are doing this work, please come to forums like this, stand up instead of me, and present your results, publish your results, so that we all start to learn from this and we can really move forward with this technology or this move in technology. And that's me. Done. Jonathan, you're back. Jolly good.
Excellent. So you're probably all sick of me by now, but apparently I still got something interesting to say. So I think before I even get to that disclaimer, or after I do, it's important to sort of make the comment that FDA doesn't really have a formal position on the role of bring your own device models that are used to support marketing applications. But nonetheless, I think there's a lot of opportunity that's clearly presented, and I think it really goes beyond just automating questionnaires. I mean, we really could potentially revolutionize the way we conduct research if you think about it. You know, you're integrating sensors and medical devices and you know, telemedicine and remote patient monitoring, and it's all really converging with personalized medicine. And these technologies, you know, we talked about medical devices and mobile apps and stuff like that, but I mean, they really bypass the traditional barriers where patients have to go through healthcare intermediates, and now they're accessing information directly. And what implications does this have for research? Well, we know the paradigm's changing in research. It's not just the hard endpoints anymore. It's not just the tumor size, the white blood cell count. We're coupling that with the soft endpoints, so to speak. How did the patient feel? What were the outcomes? How can we assess this? How can we measure this? And I think obviously these BYOD models offer unique opportunities. So I'll talk about things from a FDA inspectional perspective, cover some of the emerging trends, and highlight some considerations to consider when utilizing, I think, BYOD or mobile apps as a whole in research. So the first thing to appreciate when preparing for an FDA inspection is, what is the source? Is it on paper? Is it on the instrument? Is it a hybrid system? Is it both? And at FDA, we've really seen it all. The protocol should ideally or define what is going to be considered source, outline what systems are going to be used, and ultimately this impacts where FDA is actually going to go for a site inspection. It's not uncommon during a pre-approval inspection, we feel the need to actually go to, let's say, an ePro vendor site that's housing some of the source data itself, or a CRO. You know, it might not necessarily just be the sponsor themselves. So we want to make sure that they, you know, followed appropriate guidelines and did testing and so forth. But the most important, I think, word of this whole slide is the reconstructability. We want to really be able to assure that the information that's submitted to the FDA in support of a marketing application has a high degree of reliability. We can have confidence in the analyses and the conclusions drawn from this data set. But what is source, right? What do you mean, what is source? Well, how one defines source could vary. For example, is source the information entered directly into the instrument itself? Or is it the actual electronic data residing on a server? Or is it when it gets converted to the data management system? Or is it when it gets converted to SDTM and ATOM and then into a SAS data set? Well, it's actually all and everything in between. Right? We have to keep track and trace of what is happening at each iteration, how it's getting collected, managed, and so forth. And it's the process. That's the other second buzzword here. The process for collecting data. That's really what you're validating, if you will. For example, we mentioned the FDA released at Center for Devices a final guidance on mobile medical applications. And the focus really talks about validating the app for its intended use with less of a focus on the platform itself. And I think this principle applies equally to BYOD as well. So we're just looking at making sure that the process for where it's going and getting transmitted and the chain of custody and how it's getting stored, this is all being followed consistently. And I have already referenced the CPGM as well. Now, the purpose of this slide here is to really show you that the walls are being broken down that have traditionally defined these different systems. What we used to think of as EDC can now have you can now do randomization in EDC, and now you can build EDC into EHRs, and if you don't have enough acronyms, to twist your tongue, we got plenty more for you. But the theme is that you're really seeing kind of these system approaches. Portal-based platform technologies offer single sign-on features that are very appealing and things like that. So just realizing that there's just a lot of automation in clinical research overall. And BYOD plays, I think, a very important part. Specifically, it's this element of demonstrating equivalence across multiple modalities. We know you give the same paper forms to 100 different subjects, there's no real assessment of equivalence. But now you tell 100 subjects, use your own smartphone to collect this data. Well, there's a lot of variability. And this issue of kind of forcing upon subjects, the compliance and use of systems can actually backfire. It actually turns out there was a study where it was a global study, and they tried to have their subjects in Japan carry around this extra custom device, and they refused to. They actually had to go and custom design their own app only for this country, because that was the only way that they were going to be able to enroll subjects in this trial. So you see how being able to cater to the population needs can also drive this decision making to use BYOD, to use a custom instrument, and so forth. Fit for purpose. Well, there's a lot of human factor considerations beyond just the actual software validation piece. We're really not validating bespoke software systems anymore. You can, there's nothing that precludes you from doing so, but it's a lot of reliance on user acceptance testing and things like that. So whether it's conducting psychometric validation to assure that there's equivalence, let's say, with the use of screenshots, screen locks, right? I know that if I use my iPhone to fill out forms sometime online, it flips on me, and then I can't really read the font. It gets smaller, and that could compromise the integrity and accuracy and completeness of the data being collected. So one consideration could be to build in these kinds of features to assure that you're maintaining continuity throughout use of this app, whether you're flipping it upside down and so forth. Data life cycles, just keeping track of how it's being collected, where it's being stored, standards for transmission, assuring that data integrity is preserved throughout this process. That's really what's important. And I've already had a case example with ePRO that showed you the importance of the clinical investigator's need to retain records, not just for purposes of an FDA inspection after the fact, but also while the study is ongoing, and assuring that blinding is appropriately maintained throughout as well. Role of vendors and trusted third parties. This is a very hot topic, because a lot of the relationship is going to be established by the language in the contract, right? what services were provided, who's expected to do what at what intervals. So making that as specific as possible, in fact, the role of service level agreements actually can impact an FDA inspection. It can help direct us and understand who's, you know, primarily responsible for what at any given time. And this is especially important with respect to collection and management of data. I wanted to, again, there seems to be a lot of misperceptions that in order to fulfill this provision of sponsors not maintaining exclusive control over their information, that they have to use someone else's system. That's actually not true. What we're really talking about is controls in place to assure that the sponsor doesn't have exclusive control. Doesn't mean that the sponsor still doesn't have control. And then some even argue, even if you hire a third party that are performing these services on behalf of the sponsor, it's an extension of the sponsor themselves. So I think that's more of a nuance. The theme is that there's controls in place to prevent any bias from being introduced and for preserving data integrity throughout the process. But that's different than the actual build, design, and maintenance of the instrument itself. Let's split them out, the two. The instrument versus the actual data that's being collected from the instrument itself. So I think just to kind of pay careful attention to that. User authentication. This is especially important in these new environments that we're seeing. You know, we've seen virtual clinical trials being conducted with no brick and mortar sites, and ePRO plays a very unique role in these new types of research models. So on a smartphone, we talked about how do you make sure that it's the user who's purporting, you know, to be entering this information. We might employ unique ID, encrypted passwords, other types of restricted user access controls to, again, give a higher level of confidence that the information is accurately reflective of the individual responsible for inputting that. Medical devices. I'm not going to really go into the topic on medical devices. I'm really focused on integrating data as an output from medical devices for research purposes. So just some practical considerations. You want to make sure that the device you're using has the appropriate clearance and or approval itself, providing that it's not actually under investigational device exemption itself. There is also the consideration to assure that they're all properly calibrated and following user manuals to make sure that if there's data that's used to support FDA-regulated research, that, you know, we can rely upon that. And failure modes. We talked briefly earlier about the different possibilities, you know, handling upgrades, how to deal with, let's say, battery failures or internet access. I know there was an issue where the information was stored locally, but the audit trail was reflective of when it actually hit the server. So it was confusing because you basically had an audit trail for like 4 days of, you know, information that was in the queue that only finally got cleared. And so how are you handling this? How are you sort of building in these sort of considerations during the design phase? And it's also, I think, an important consideration whether or not you're going to exclude certain devices. You know, we are only going to allow subjects that have iPhone 4S's and 5's and Samsung S3's, etc., as these models. Every other, you know, Nokias and so forth are just going to be excluded. I mean, I think that's a reasonable consideration. Now, you might not have that luxury. And then you go back, well, then do I have to do, you know, equivalence testing across 50 different for every screenshots? And well, you may have to. I think it's just a matter of, like I said, there's a lot of flexibility granted to the sponsors, CROs, and vendors to provide a solution that's most appropriate for their particular study. So again, there's no really one answer, one size fits all sort of approach that I can give you. But last but not least is the monitoring considerations. We're moving away from source data verification itself. And in this new environment, what are you looking at? We talked about looking at, you know, audit trails, changes to those data that's most critical, eligibility, safety, and efficacy data. Also, focusing more on the clinical plausibility of information. Is it really possible that they're feeling this, that they've, you know, haven't slept for the last 10 days, or, you know, that they, you know, have not been able to breathe for the last 5 days or so forth? So I think, you know, looking beyond just comparing Apple, you know, does that superficial audit, does the eight match the eight? But is that eight really reflective of the information that was captured? So in conclusion, I just have a couple more references, and I believe we can now turn to Jason, who will moderate the panel session. Thank you.